Welcome to Footnotes of History, the podcast that inspects the past and finds that 95% of facts available are educational. With you as always are myself, Tim Philpott, and our local education commissioner, Daniel Nesbitt.
How are you doing?
Yeah, good, thanks, Tim. I'm good.
Excellent.
I'm looking forward to this episode and, you know, hopefully teaching people about the Newcastle Commission, which I had no idea about before I started actually researching.
Well, that's a good thing, because that means we're all learning.
Yeah.
Including, well, as we'll find out, some children.
Yeah.
And so 95% of the children. Yeah. Yeah, indeed. So maybe we should dive. Well, let's. So the period we're talking about is sort of eight. First of all, what is the Newcastle Commission? Is it a royal commission? It's a board of members of parliament, essentially, that was set up. And officials set up to inspect the system of schooling in England and Wales in 1859, and then published its findings in 1861.
Yeah, and I think it was basically trying to establish whether the government was getting value for its money and how good the education was in Britain at the time.
Yeah,
wasn't it?
Yeah,
just to kind of the basis.
Yeah, I think they yeah, they I think they referred to it as sort of like the popular education, so to speak. Like popular music, you might say,
So we're talking about 1860s to this time, aren't we?
It's the crossover date between the 1850s and 1860s.
Yeah. So kind of at the moment we're talking American Civil War.
Yeah.
In this period.
Yeah. We should go into the context. So American Civil War is not long after.
Yeah. 1861 to 1865.
Yeah. Yeah.
Then looking at our previous episodes, we've done Cobden and Chevalier.
Yeah.
Sort of trade deals between France and Britain happening in 1860. So yeah. It's kind of like almost like a liberalising time in some ways, in the time of.
Yeah.
People trying to do things and to improve other people's lives.
Yeah.
I think that's what they're
thrust of the area. Definitely politicians. And obviously the man in charge at the time is, as I'm sure everybody knows, the Viscount Palmerston, who, as we referred to in another episode, is Mr. Gumbo Diplomacy. But also Mr. Liberal, because he is, well, he was first a Whig and then the very first Liberal Prime Minister.
Father of the Liberals.
Indeed, father of the Liberals. From
and now a cat.
Yes, I know.
He's a very fine looking cat.
Yeah. Was it the Foreign Office?
He's the Foreign Office.
Yeah.
He fights with the 10 Downing Street cat.
Yeah.
Larry.
And usually wins.
He ripped his collar off the other day.
Yeah, so
there's a picture of fur and a collar on Downing Street.
Yeah.
It's horrific scenes.
It's the fact that everyone plays so close attention to this, slightly disturbing. But yeah, so lots of things are happening. It's a sort of time of, and obviously, like I said, we're talking about sort of the late 1850s, 1860s. Mm. It is a time of governments feeling much more like they have to sort of provide things for their populace, unlike sort of previously, much more sort of expansive in the realm of. You know, for example, in France, obviously you have Napoleon III building his large boulevards and so
and trying to compete with Britain in many ways.
Yeah, exactly.
Trying to like raise his country up.
Yeah, exactly. Trying to instill some industrialization. You've got the Industrial Revolution kicking off in a big way in Britain. Obviously, we covered quite a lot of this in the Industrial Revolution at Sea episode 7. Indeed, Smoke on the Water, I couldn't remember what it was called. Which brings me on to today's episode, which is footnotesofhistory.com/13. Mm. Sorry, I forgot the episode then. Let's start with a very, very broad question. What should we sort of think of when we think of education in this period?
I think one thing we need to also think about,
yeah,
when we've gone a bit further, a step back from that, is also children this period.
Yeah.
I think it's so important to remember that almost from age 9 onwards, they were being employed in factories.
Yeah.
And they were working as well as their parents. Yeah. And they were seen as quite a vital source of income as well.
Indeed. Given the choice between starving or working, I suppose in many ways that was the preferred choice.
So I think we have to also bear this in mind when we talk about schooling. We're also talking about people who are also working as well.
Yeah, exactly.
So I think that's very easy, something we need to bear in mind when we talk about the schooling.
Yeah.
And this is the period where I think people were starting to think, actually, we've got a load of people who are working from 9 onwards. They're not really learning in any way to actually better themselves or, give themselves a chance in life. They're just straight out into work, exactly what their parents did. So I think in many ways this is some of the sort of rationale behind the reforms that are coming through. Indeed, actually, how can we get them a little bit better? How can we do something to actually better the lives a little bit?
Yeah, there was a lot, I would say, a lot of the Newcastle Commission's discussion did revolve around, and especially the discussion which led to the founding of the Newcastle Commission was what is the right education for children, basically? Yeah. Which, as you can imagine, had a lot of different opinions from different sides of the I say different sides of the aisle. I mean, different segments of society all over.
And it's quite interesting you mentioned about how different. What's the right approach for schooling? Because when you look at them, you have so many different types of schools already. Yeah. So you have Anglican national schools who were run by the church, workhouse schools. So everyone knows the workhouse from sort of Dickens sort of writings. Poor children who are being to be abandoned or don't have parents can't afford to bring them up, being educated in some way, non-conformist schools, so schools that have religious overtones but aren't related to the sort of Anglican faith and aren't related to the established church.
Yeah.
There was also a move to try and get factory schools involved, which is where the government was trying to, in some ways...
was that part of the 1830s Factory Act was to sort of slightly curb child labour, for very young children at least, and try and... It's sort of almost a semi-apprenticeship.
Yeah, it is. So factory owners would only be able to employ 9 to 13-year-olds if they could prove that they'd had 2 hours schooling each day.
Yeah.
And the sort of rationale behind this was they were hoping that the factory owners would establish their own schools on the factory premises, which would then educate them.
Yeah.
Didn't quite work because the children went to schools near the factories, but they weren't run by the factories.
Yeah.
So that was one element. You also had dame schools, which were...
Yeah.
Kind of.
Well, they would basically have one teacher who was not. the general impression is considered quite negative. Mm. But I think there's very little evidence that the inspectors actually understood them very well.
I think there's
one person basically teaching
out. Generally, it was almost like a childcare facility. One woman teaching a group of children.
Yeah,
they were meant to get sort of English, maths, grammar education at these times, and as we'll see later in the episode. The commission took one very strong view on this, and it's probably one of the more controversial elements of it, but we'll come back to that when we look at their findings.
I was going to say, there are a couple of other things worth mentioning in the school spectrum, I suppose, because it's not, when we think of a school, obviously we're thinking of the modern day school, which is a sort of classroom with people in and whatever. There are various different sources of this kind of schooling. One huge one that we shouldn't forget is that parents obviously taught their own kids to read quite a lot of time. And you had sort of literary and philosophy societies, mechanics institutes, Sunday schools. Mm. I mean, obviously those former probably more for adult education than others, than the third one. But should we move on to the findings of the... You were going to say Newcastle himself and the commission.
Well, so I want to one more thing, or a couple of things I wanted to go before we go into the commission itself, is just a bit of background on how these schools worked in some ways. So, I mean, what a lot of it was taught in was called the monitorial system, which is basically where you have one teacher with some like senior pupils who are like his subordinates, who will then, he will teach them, and then they will go into the class and teach the rest of the children.
The younger children. Yeah. As in like they, it's just like a senior, these are senior pupils, they're senior, who will then teach those junior pupils.
Yeah, and see, and it was quite effective because one teacher with a few
helpers
would be able to teacher classes of hundreds, well, 120 is one of the figures that's given quite a lot. So they'd sit in long rooms with the teacher at his desk, and then the subordinates like going out into them. And this way he'd want to teach children, also train his next generation of helpers.
Well, they become more familiar with the material.
And so that
it's just really interesting actually, because when I was younger, and you'd be like, "Oh, yeah, I'm a classroom monitor."
Yeah.
I was like, "That's where that came from." Even though the role is completely different now, obviously, but
then we have the milk monitors.
What am I monitoring?
I suppose you would monitor milk before Thatcher came and snatched it.
Yeah, of course.
Which is an incorrection. part of history.
Part of history. Yeah. There's a footnote on that. Yeah. We should mention that it was actually Edward Heath's government.
Yeah, and she was the one sort of, like saddled with the task of implementing it. Wasn't her idea.
Yeah. Anyway, imagine that saved loads of money though. Anyway, just, do you know what I mean? Like, it's one of those pointless.
Well, what I heard was that loads of children had rickets and all their teeth fell out after they took the milk away because that was the only thing holding it there.
Yeah.
It wasn't that they were forced to drink this horrible lukewarm milk. Yeah, it was really helpful to them.
Yeah. Now we have free school meals, so you get milk as well and a full meal as well.
I bet she's spinning in her grave.
Yeah. Anyway.
Think of all the free school meals, like snatch.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway.
Going off topic.
Yeah,
Although, actually, you know, that public funding of schools actually links quite back into what we were going to talk about a bit of it. So the lead up to the Newcastle Commission is all about how public funding started.
Yeah.
So, you know, before 1833, there wasn't a huge amount of public funding, of state funding of schools. And I think it also, from what I read, it started in 1833 with a grant of £20,000 for the construction of school buildings. That's kind of like the first sort of flag in, you know, in the ground of when the state kind of properly intervened and started paying for schooling.
Anyway. I think we mentioned this, but it was also did we mention this? I can't remember. But the part of the Factory Act, obviously,
was
try and get kids out of factories, basically.
Yeah,
at least younger children out of factories. Yeah.
Yeah, and this, I think it kind of grew exponentially over the next 30 or so years. So by 1860, it's over £700,000 is being invested in schools. So, you know, this has happened really quickly. You know, and it's quite big sums of money by this point as well.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, and this at this point, the government is now starting to think, are we getting value for money?
I think one of the points actually that people raise in we'll go into this in more detail later, but the Crimean War has just ended, and there were lots of very concerned deficit hawks basically around, who were sort of, you know, the people who were very worried about the government spending basically.
Yeah.
And that this would influence Newcastle Commission's conclusions, but we'll go on to that in more detail.
Yeah, and I think the one last thing we should also point out this time is that, as we've touched on already, a lot of people are trying to do a lot of things to do with education, and this has created quite huge splits
internationally.
In Britain, but internationally as well. But in Britain as well, you've got sort of Tories and Anglicans. So what we'd probably now see is sort of like the establishment, sort of in political and religious form.
So you've
got the Tory party and then the Anglicans, who are the
sort of wealthy landowners as well as sort of
high church.
What's it used in the Irish? Oh, old money.
basically that kind of like, and sort of like the established church were on one side, because their basic view was the government's funding these schools, therefore the church, the established religion of the
should be taught to them,
and they should have a degree of control over what's being taught.
Yeah.
On the other side, you had the Whigs and the non-conformists and the Catholics, to an extent, who's saying actually it shouldn't all be just driven down these Anglican lines. You should be able to,
I think they took a much more American approach, like a separation of church.
Exactly.
If the state's going to be doing this, we can't also have the church.
Public funding should also come to Catholic and non-conformist sectors as well,
exactly,
so they can teach their own ways. And this is kind of like a divine line throughout, I think, the period.
I think also, you know, just moving in on that point, which I'll probably talk about a bit later as well, but that divide actually was part of the reason why the British government was so sort of behind in terms. If you compare it in relation to other European countries and America as well, actually, especially in the Massachusetts, sort of Boston, Massachusetts region, they're quite far behind. And this sectarian divide is the reason why, because it resisted basically.
Yeah, and I think they were so divided, it blocked almost all change for a while, because you'd have the Whigs proposing a bill and it'd be like vitriolically opposed by the Tories, so then they were back down, then it'd be vice versa, and it was like nothing really got done.
Yeah.
So do you want to talk, just before we go on to the Newcastle Commission, do you want to do a little quick talk about what's happening internationally? Because I think
we've
seen, obviously, in Britain, stuff's being tried and done about education. And it's not just in Britain it's happening.
Yeah.
It's happening throughout Europe and also around in America as well, that, you know, they're waking up to the fact that, you know, we probably should look at how we're educating young people.
Well, there was definitely an impetus on creating some kind of system of education that was, I mean, well, you can, I mean, I think listeners can decide for themselves what the reasons were. Mm. But in many countries, let's say Frederick the Great, the Prussian system. I mean, by 1870, obviously Prussia had become. Or Germany had become Prussia had become Germany.
Yeah,
Prussia.
Or
Italy,
you could say that you
formed
could,
Germany.
You could say it also worked vice versa, didn't it? That Germany had become
indeed
Prussia as well, because they basically dominated everything.
So yeah, like, exactly. Yeah,
you know, Germany became Germans became Prussian.
Yeah,
as well as Prussians became German.
Yeah, and you know, just stepping sort of through the progress of that. Obviously, the reason that Bismarck famously said, through blood and iron." Yeah, so well, basically through war, basically they managed to do this. Frederick the Great implemented a sort of state education system that was compulsory in order to make his essentially armies less cowardly. and have more loyalty towards him. And you know, this is
yeah. And I think it's quite interesting because this is a lot earlier than what we're talking about Frederick the Great, and he's 1700s.
Yeah, so exactly.
You can see almost that Prussia, I think, you know, becomes sort of the envy of a lot of countries in terms of its education system. They try and replicate it. So I also had a quick look at it in 1830, so a little bit before the time we're talking about. They had free primary schooling in place. They had professional teachers trained in colleges. So that was another thing that Britain couldn't quite agree on, exactly who was teaching the teachers and how they were being taught.
Well, again, Prussia was very sure of itself in terms of religion as well.
That's where that helps, because they didn't have this split because they and then they had a system of funding to build schools in place. They had inspections of sort of to ensure good teaching as well. So I mean, it's quite advanced in some ways. And also, one other example I wanted to quickly talk about was France.
Yeah.
So almost around the same time, you had the what are called.
Is this around 1860s?
This is 1850. Sorry. Okay, just about a decade beforehand, you had the Folau laws.
As Napoleon III came.
Yeah. So he was still president of France at this point. So not in his imperial phase just yet, but he was still controlling what was going on. Yeah. And so they had a reform of education, and it was along religious lines, so it was more in tune with Britain in some ways, in terms of actually having religion very strongly there. Of course, it was Catholic, so it was ensuring that.
I'm sort of guessing here because I'm not sure which bit you're. I don't know the details of the bit you're talking about, but before with Napoleon the First, which presumably Napoleon the Third got a lot of his inspiration from. That would probably be no surprise. his whole concept was, again, they tried to do it under the revolution, but it kind of failed again because of religious divides, and the utilitarians were like, the radical Jacobins were like, this is unacceptable. We can't have state, we can't have religious education.
Yeah.
And then obviously Napoleon came in, the head of the father of the nation, so to speak, fully inserting Catholicism back into society, where we must have education by the state and Catholicism must be part of it.
Yeah,
and they must all worship me.
Yeah, and this is exactly what some of these laws were about. So I mean, they had a big argument over who was how far religion should intrude.
Yeah,
I think Victor Hugo actually came down strongly against religion coming into education. It did. So I mean, a couple of things. They had a system of primary education put in place by these laws in 1850. So every commune over 500 people had to have both a boys' and a girls' school in the commune, which is quite
advanced. That was a lot of laws. Like you had to have one.
Yeah, that was quite interesting thing, I thought.
It's interesting
from the international perspective.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah, that's really interesting. I think also the international perspective comes up as well, because when the findings of the commission. They are always comparing Britain to Prussia and France as well, actually, but mostly Prussia. Go on.
All I was going to say was basically, should we talk about Newcastle itself?
We should. I think we should do that quite quickly. Yeah. Okay. Sorry, I don't want to be that guy. But yeah, what do you know about Newcastle?
Well, his name was Henry Pelham Clinton. So that's immediately painting this sort of picture of sort of.
What kind of guy?
I kind of like think of him as the archetypal Victorian politician, because he represented various different constituencies, because I think they kept getting reorganised. And then he became...
Obviously in 1833 had the Reform Act.
Then he became the Duke of Newcastle. Newcastle under Lyme. Neither of us knew this at this place existed before we started looking at it.
And as you mentioned, there may be my fourth Newcastle, some of that we don't know.
Yeah, exactly. Well, anyone who has heard of it,
possibly
write in and tell us.
Episode 10.
And also, throughout his career, he was part of three different parties, because the party lines kept shifting and reforming. And he was a Tory to begin with, then became a Peelite under Robert Peel. And then he became a Liberal under Palmerston, as we spoke about earlier. And it was during his Liberal phase that he chaired this commission.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that makes sense, because, first of all, Palmerston obviously is the first leader. The Liberal, the father of Liberals, and so he's like, obviously Liberal in charge because he's a Liberal. It also shows, you can see where his politics is. He was once a Peelite, and then he moves into a Liberal sort of thing. He is, I mean, I hesitate to say classical Liberal sort of leaning, but it does seem, he obviously was interested in... he wasn't interested in static government.
No, he's a reformer. Kind of thing. He wanted them to do something, I think.
whatever it is, just do it.
Just do something.
Yeah, go on.
But no, that was what I was going to say. In 1859, Palmerston became Prime Minister. I think quite quickly afterwards, the commission got set up, didn't
they? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it was in 1859 that the commission was set up. Funnily enough, actually only took 2 years to complete its... Yeah. Only 2 years. I mean,
that could teach some. I mean, when they did inquiries that go on now.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe that's my perspective. But the Chilcot inquiry went on for like 15 years or something. Mm. Anyway, yeah, let's not get into that. Minefield. Oh wow.
Campbell's here.
Anyway, yeah. So should we move on to the findings of the commission?
Yes, absolutely.
The concrete. So the commission obviously. We should. So the commission actually conducted its process, I suppose, by two branches of investigation. Mm-hmm. The first was sending literal inspectors to schools to inspect them, obviously, and report on their findings. And then the second one was asking for statistics from religious and public religious sources and public departments, which, as we mentioned, the Anglican church schools were actually quite a huge part of the system. Mm. Anything jump out at you from the findings?
Well, it's quite interesting. I thought that it was actually. They found that there was just around 2.6 million of children of school age in Britain at the time, and of those, 2.5 million were in education, which is, you know, when you think about Victorian times, kind of think of orphans and wastrels and other things. So I mean, it was quite interesting. Only around 120,000 were classified as not being in some form of education, to my mind, anyway. You can argue about the quality of that education, but it's quite an interesting statistic to say that actually.
Yeah.
The vast majority of children in Britain at the time were getting some kind of basic education.
Yeah.
You know, it's something we probably...
95%,
if not more, I think.
It was 95% had 6 years, I think that was... Mm. It doesn't sound like a lot now, but you compare it to time.
Yeah, and I think it's for our mindset of thinking, you know, these people were probably just uneducated slobs, or like, you know, they were just left by the wayside to, you know, die or something. But actually, there was stuff going on at the time already that was, you know... that a lot of people were being educated to some degree.
Yeah, absolutely. Although essentially what the conclusions of the commission were that there were sort of significant geographical gaps where fast growing cities, like, you know, the south of London, for example, fast growing towns and cities were there was a sort of gap, as it were, in the education coverage, but. Well, I think one of the things that they found quite surprising was that the schools would pop up, you know, private schools would pop up, or church schools or whatever, would pop up to serve the new need very quickly. It wasn't very long that they would be sort of not covered by a school, as it were. I say covered, but I mean, they often have competing schools.
Yeah, I think when you'll get to that point where you'll have... yeah. You have probably have a period of time where if you're in a new industrial city, the families will have moved with the workers.
Yeah.
They'll have then come to the point where actually there is no school here, and it will take a while, but they will eventually, the demand will be there, so the school will, you know, follow, kind of thing, in many ways.
Yeah.
So there won't be a ready-made school in this area.
Yeah.
But once the families get there,
once there are people there, then somebody will probably have the idea of making one, which I think is fair enough. Anyway, so 95% of 95% of the children of school age, which they sort of worked out, de facto, I suppose. Like it wasn't like they were imposing their own views on it, which is quite an interesting phenomenon actually for a government sort of commission. But anyway, they discovered quite an interesting phenomenon was that the percentage of children in school was actually higher than or comparable with quite a lot of nations that already had compulsory state-funded education systems, which I thought was fascinating.
Yeah.
Also,
one other thing I wanted to point out just is it. I think it kind of shows how much children are part of the workforce as well.
Yeah.
Because it was the one thing I saw was all but around 19% of children. So, getting towards 80% of children were in primary departments. So, up to age 12, and then. You can clearly show from age 12, you know, formal education stopped and you went to work full time. So I mean, I think it clearly just shows how different times were and how how childhood stopped a lot earlier than it did. Yeah. You know, it's not a surprising thing to say, but I think seeing it there in black and white kind of reinforced the fact that these children were, they were valued members of the workforce of the family because they were needed to bring in more
money. It wasn't like the family couldn't afford to have them.
Yeah, you can't
just sort of
lazing around at university.
I guess that's the that is the option there. I think we should move on to unless you wanted to add anything else.
No, I think also one thing you might want to point out is dame schools. Oh, came down quite hard on dame schools, as I remember.
Yeah,
I think this is something that you dislike.
Well, I just thought it was annoying because it is annoying. I mean, I read Phil Gardner's book on the lost elementary schools of Victorian England, sort of emphasised this, and he sort of said that basically the inspectors did not actually understand the system they were inspecting.
Mm.
I mean, not just the Newcastle Commission, but other inspections that had taken place before and after this, essentially said that a dame school, as you mentioned earlier, sort of summoned this image of some sort of wizened old lady.
It's quite a rustic image. I think you can imagine the inspectors seeing it as sort of like almost an unrefined type.
And inefficient as well, for the time, this kind of like efficiency kind of argument. Mm. But all these kids sort of sat around on her sofas, and she's got some tea, and it's just like learn some times tables or something. Mm. Long story short, Phil Gardner emphasises that they didn't really understand what it was that were being. Well, first of all, he emphasised that literacy, the literacy figures speak for themselves. Literacy was actually. Some of the highest in Europe compared to compulsory systems in other countries, first of all. And then secondly, that when they tried to categorise dame schools versus day schools, which we're referring to the old Anglican church schools and so on, there isn't actually, when they describe them, there's no real difference between them most of the time. There's one person teaching. Quite often they refer to a person, quite often a man as well, in a classroom teaching a class as a dame school. Just because it's sort of not teaching a curriculum that they recognise potentially or something like that. Anyway, that was a slight bee in my bonnet when I read.
Well, it's quite an interesting one. Because they come down really quite hard against them. And they see them as being not what people should be in.
Indeed. The right education, as I said. Yeah, one of the so we can move on to the recommendations straight from that. One of their points was that some people are not getting the right education, and once again we could.
Quibble about what the right
is. Exactly. Especially if they're Anglicans or whatever. So religion obviously plays a part in that, essentially. And nationalism and so on. But and one of the other points is that they were going to fill in the gaps.
Yeah, I think that thing is key. It goes back to your sort of point about how they found geographic differences.
Yeah.
You had some areas that were very good, other areas that weren't very good. I think they were kind of like trying to take the patchwork effect away from education. And other bits that I found quite interesting in their recommendations were this... They had
using state funding.
Using state funding, they've kind of accepted that state funding should remain.
Yeah.
They wanted it more results based, so they will have a small sum of money that was given up front, but then the rest would be dependent on results. So they wanted to have sort of regular results being tested to ensure the schools were being effective. And they were, this is one thing they found was that objectives were being set too high for a lot of children. So they wanted to make sure that they were at an achievable level and that those levels were being achieved. And at that point, more money would be released.
Yeah. Did you say testing?
Payment by results type thing.
I can see where the sort of coming from that, I suppose. It's a sort of it's important to point out as well when we talk about the recommendations. There was a not exactly a minority report, but like a couple of comments from members of the commission that not disagree. They took a slightly less expansive view than potentially Newcastle himself or Palmerston might have on this.
I've got an image of Newcastle being played by Tom Cruise in the film.
Really? That was bizarre.
Minority Report, the film.
Oh, of course. Yeah. Sorry. I thought you meant like climbing a mountain or something.
He's probably riding a motorbike because Tom Cruise does that in every film he's in. So Newcastle could get to his committee meeting on a motorbike and then storm in and start talking about payment by results.
So the Newcastle report itself said that there exists among the commission, as among the nation at large, deeply seated differences of opinion with regard to the duty of government in this country towards education.
Mm.
And then they said Like divisions in class, religion, and character of the nation may have been avoided in the past without the original government grant system of 1833. If the state proceeds on its present course, it will be difficult hereafter to induce parental and social duty to undertake the burden which it ought to bear.
Mm.
I.e. parents might start just not teaching their children, which they are.
Because the state
do it. Exactly. Yeah. And then finally, which is kind of the most aggressive one, actually, it will be impossible to escape from the position, neither just in itself nor socially expedient, that large and ill-defined classes of the people are entitled, without reference to individual need or natural claims, to have their education paid for out of public taxes. So there you go.
Yeah. Chilling words.
Should we move on to the sort
results?
Start wrapping up and start talking about, you know, the aftermath and the legacy of.
Yeah. Well, I think in many ways it kind of didn't really solve a lot.
No, it didn't. Like, they carried out the recommendations in a sense.
Yeah.
But they didn't go all in. Or they didn't
and also,
go all
like,
out.
You didn't have these problems. Like, I think I saw one thing saying the religious problem wasn't really solved. So you still have these arguments over where the money was going, who was controlling it.
Yeah.
Which denomination got to teach and what influenced the situation.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think the article I was reading was calling it the Gordian knot wasn't cut until much later than this.
So the state was still paralysed as far as education.
Yeah. And I think
quite a long time.
Yeah. So I think, yeah, anyway,
9 years at least.
Yeah.
Well, I will bring on to that in a minute. But 1870, obviously, you start getting this quite a large public education budget. God, sorry.
So maybe it was more of a sort of a milestone rather than an ending kind of thing. It was a point along the way that's influential, but not didn't solve it in the end.
Yeah,
is one way we could look at it. Perhaps.
Indeed. Yeah. Shall I move on to the sort of 1870?
Yeah, do you want to give it like an overview? So we've had
very brief
Newcastle Commission in many ways. You know, the stuff was implemented, targets were lowered. Some people were saying that education regressed a bit because the lower targets brought with it lower results.
Potentially, yeah.
But it didn't solve the main issues of exactly the funding element and the religious element.
Indeed.
So yeah,
if
you want to talk a little bit about.
Yeah. Well, I think to be honest, actually, I find that the Newcastle Commission actually sort of found, you know, given the original questions, like how. What is education like? It's like, well, it's sort of alright.
It's not too bad.
It's pretty decent considering we haven't done anything.
So yeah, like considering evolving.
Yeah.
In many ways, it's evolving course in some ways.
In 1870, the Forster Act, the Elementary Education Act, was passed, which sort of provided a lot more funding for basically enabled public funding of schools in a much larger way. States can't save funding for schools in a much larger way. And it's sort of interesting to look at the reasons why this was implemented, and religion is up there.
Mm.
One of the, you know, when it came to campaign, the National Education League, which campaigned quite heavily for this bill in 1870, which, you know, claimed to be acting on the Newcastle Commission's recommendations, said that, you know, schooling should be essentially. Found discomfort in the fact that so much schooling was happening in churches and wanted it to be taken over by the government instead to make it non-sectarian. And one of the big campaigners on this was Joseph Chamberlain, one-time mayor and also MP for Birmingham during this period, who campaigned on this. But eventually, when the bill was passed, it provided funds for Anglican schools as well. So it was sort of like, you know, nobody really won that one. Public education or state-funded education, if you like, was created, but almost didn't really achieve any of the objectives that anyone who campaigned for it actually wanted, other than the provision of education. But, yeah. I mean, it wasn't compulsory education, but it was quite a large expansion of state-funded education. Mm. Compulsory education came a bit like 1880, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Something we're going to look at in a future episode, isn't it?
Yeah.
We're going to talk a bit more about that because that came with its own controversies
and
issues. But I think it's quite a fascinating one we'll come back to.
Yeah.
And do you have any sort of further reading? I think you've amassed quite a few books on this.
Yeah, I have. This is sort of a bit of a
rundown on the Phil Gardner one as well.
Yeah. So, yeah, the main ones which are really interesting on this, I mean, there are surprisingly few books on the Newcastle Commission.
Mm.
and even fewer books that try and take an alternative view of it. So I've tried to highlight the alternative view, as we try slightly to do on the Furniture History some of the time, just to keep people thinking and on their toes. There's The Lost Elementary Schools of Victorian England by Phil Gardner, which is it takes a deep dive essentially into what it was that these dame schools or these day schools, whatever they wanted to call them really, were actually teaching. And Edwin West's Education and the State, a study in political economy, which again is takes the alternative view of the Newcastle Commission in terms of the recommendations and what was happening before.
Mm-hmm. And I would also like to add into that one the Newcastle Commission itself.
Indeed,
quite an interesting read.
When I was reading through it, I was fascinated at how it sort of had these sort of internal. It's almost as if the person who wrote it was literally verbatim writing down the internal debates that were going on within the commission.
Probably more interesting than any government report has a right to be.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Or this episode.
Yeah, sort of on that note.
On that terrible disappointment.
Yeah, I think it's been an interesting topic. I think we've got into sort of looked at a few of the myths around Victorian schooling, showed that actually it was a bit more present than people think it was there.
Indeed.
And showed that actually there was feeling that the key thing was lots of people felt that something needed to be done.
Yeah.
They just couldn't figure out or agree on what needed to be done.
Indeed.
Some of the key elements of it.
Well, I think in some ways it was very much like they felt that something needed to be done, but the Newcastle Commission, I feel like, everyone has their different opinions, but I feel like it sort of highlighted how successful the system that was not a compulsory system as practiced in other states was actually in educating people.
Yeah, it's kind of reassuring, as we said, in some ways, that even though it's still very much evolving, it's evolving in the right direction.
Indeed,
it's still, leave people to their own devices and it'll go in the right way, roughly. You might have a few bumps on the road, but you'll get there.
Indeed, it's interesting.
Thanks for listening to Footnotes of History. For more episodes, visit footnotesofhistory.com and subscribe. Or, if you want to suggest an episode to us, email us on episodes@footnotesofhistory.com. You can also follow us on social media at FOH Podcast to Twitter, and we're also on Instagram and YouTube. Thanks for listening.